Hey there, this is Seth Waters of Channel 9 coming from the beautiful New York offices of Microsoft in, this is Midtown Manhattan, right?
It is Midtown Manhattan.
Midtown Manhattan, we're on the 6th floor. I'm here with my good friend, Andrew Bruss. How you doing, buddy?
How are you? Good to see you in New York.
Yes, anytime I come to New York, I try to talk to you about data because, awesome. I mean, that's what we do. Why don't you tell people what you do, my friend?
So I'm at a company called Datamere, which is a big data software company. We have business user, kind of end user oriented analytics software that runs directly on big data technology like Hadoop and Spark.
So before we talk, because I want to talk to you about that, tell us a little bit about, because you were an analyst in big data and data science.
Yep.
Why don't you sort of give us an overview of what the field like is now, like just a snapshot of where you think things are when it comes to big data?
Yeah, it's a little bit at a crossroads, to be honest. I mean, I still write about big data for ZDNet as well, so that's not quite being an analyst anymore, but I kind of write with an analyst's outlook, I suppose. So, you know, when big data really got started in earnest, let's say 5 years ago, really 6 years ago, it was very immature. It was very idealistic. It was full of companies and people and technology that was all about kind of not being like all the database and BI technology that came before it. And the upside of that was we really got a lot of innovative technology that wasn't, you know, kind of constricted by old ways of thinking of how you deal with data. Mm-hmm. The downside was we really had a lot of software that wasn't ready for the enterprise and didn't really take things like security or usability or kind of manageability into consideration.
Sure.
So we've been in a process, I would say, for the last 2 or 3 years now where the companies are maturing, which means they need enterprise dollars, which means they need enterprise customers, which means the software has to work in an enterprise environment. And most of the companies in the big data field have been gradually, you know, working towards that goal. I will say that Datamere, and I knew the company before I joined it, was always kind of focused on enterprise usability. That's
sure.
What made it kind of unique is because it stood in between these extremes of radical new technology and button-down BI stuff and said, there is a way to kind of combine the two.
That's an interesting thing because I remember there was like this revolution of anti-relational theory, for example,
sure.
that sort of crept up. Tell us a little bit about sort of those things that came up that was sort of like a, we don't need to do this anymore the way, because relational theories have been around since the 70s, right?
Yep.
And then there was this sort of revolution. Tell us about that revolution and what came out of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring it up because I just wrote about it like last week, the so-called NoSQL databases were really a misnomer even from the beginning because it was less about the query language and more about the engine and things like indexing and
sure.
joins and relational schema. So the rejection was a rejection of very formal schema and putting tables together relationally and doing everything in a normalized fashion. The idea was, and it was born of necessity from big internet companies like Yahoo, like Google,
sure.
like LinkedIn, who really needed databases that were optimized for very low latency writes. And a lot of the things that we need from a relational database in line of business applications, like referential integrity,
sure.
for example, or atomic transactions, those were really secondary. So you ended up with these databases where it was sort of low latency or bust, and suddenly a bunch of things you expect from a database weren't there. That too has matured, and we're now seeing virtually every NoSQL database now honoring SQL as a query language and adding more and more relational features. And I think what we're gonna end up with, I hope so, because I predicted this a few years ago, is we're not going to have relational databases and NoSQL databases. We're going to have a spectrum of databases that are kind of more relationally oriented, but have NoSQL features, and at the other end, the opposite. And it's really just going to be a range of options. And actually, Microsoft's DocumentDB is noteworthy in that respect, because from the second it came out, it was based on the idea that the latency versus the consistency of the database was adjustable. So you didn't have to go to one extreme. You could actually pick your trade-off. and you could do that by table. And so that's still a big hallmark of that database.
And I love the idea of being able to do trade-offs, because everything we do in technology is a trade-off. And so that's why when anyone ever tells me, hey, you should always or you should never, my bit flips, and I'm like, what?
I agree. Yeah. Technology that's doctrinaire is often, I mean, it's often very motivated, very dedicated engineering teams, and so they get to good achievements. Mm-hmm. But doctrine doesn't work real well in the professional world of software.
So let's talk about the look back now to sort of the old school stuff and how it's actually making, because I don't disagree that it was a revolution when the NoSQL stuff happened. It was right. It was great. And some of the greatest ideas came out, some great ideas. But tell me a little bit about how they're looking back and adding back in things that maybe they should have had it all the time.
Sure. And I mean, to be fair to the NoSQL guys, I think the relational database incumbents became very doctrinaire.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
We must do everything this
absolutely.
Way.
So, I agree.
Not surprising that there was a bit of a rebellion against that. But at this point, what we're seeing is a response to the competitive threat from the NoSQL databases, and we're seeing the incumbents bring in more and more NoSQL-like features into the database. For SQL Server 2016, arguably the biggest change there is the ability to handle JSON-based data. Mm-hmm. A lot of NoSQL databases, a whole category of them called document stores, are based on storing JSON documents.
Sure.
So now SQL Server has some of that capability as well. It's not to say SQL Server is a NoSQL database. It's not. You still need schema. You still need indices and everything you needed before. But if what you really want to do is deal with data as JSON objects, you now have that capability. You also see things like DB2, and this goes back a couple of years, adding an interface where you can program it with the MongoDB API. So as you know, MongoDB kind of one of the foundational and dominant NoSQL databases. Its API is now honored by DB2. It's also honored by DocumentDB, going back to the Microsoft world. So you can actually treat DocumentDB as a cloud-based managed MongoDB if you wanted to look at it that way.
It almost feels like there's a good convergence so that it's easy to switch in and out between different providers. Would you say that's the case?
We're getting there. I think that's the ideal. I don't think it's where we are right now, but it's definitely, you know, if you fit things to a curve, right, that's where it's going.
So let's talk about what big data actually means, because I have people come to me and say, hey, Seth, I need to do big data, and then I look at their MDF file, and it's like 3 gigabytes, and I'm like,
Yeah.
You know, if it fits in RAM, maybe it's not big data. Why don't you talk about what big data is in your perspective, and then what are some of the technologies today that people are using to sort of deal with that type of data?
Yeah. And I mean, you're right in that it's a sliding definition depending on, you know, what vendor or what audience you're talking to, what big is. What I've said to audiences at sessions at conferences is, if you put me in a corner and you make me quantify how big is, I would say it's hundreds of terabytes into petabyte scale. Petabyte being 1,000 or 1,024, depending on your generation, terabytes, exactly. So if you forced me, that's how I would do it. I would rather say, though, that you're in the realm of big data if you're using a more conventional operational database, be it NoSQL or relational, and it's falling down. If you are starting to exceed the limits of an operational database, that's a sign you're in the realm of big data. And I prefer that definition because I think no matter where we quantify it now, that will change.
Sure.
I think, you know, petabyte scale on SQL Server will, you know, be the rule more than the exception at some point in the future. But for a lot of other people, big data is, well, it's big if I have to hit page down to get to more rows. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Or if I'm using big data technology, and we'll talk about what some of those are, if I'm using big data technology, it must be big data. I used to kind of feel very strongly that that was, I don't know, pretentious and wrong. At this point, I would say pretty much everybody's going to need to be kind of agile back and forth. We're going to have small data, we're going to have big data, and it's not that one's better, cooler, or more robust than the other. Actually, when you start with big data, your goal is to get to something a lot smaller and more aggregated so that you can do some analysis in a realistic way.
And I like the approach of, like, it was a little pretentious of me to say, oh, 3 gigs is not big data, but you might be using big data techniques in preparation for the amount of data that you will have in the future. And it's better to do that now than to sort of wave your hands in the air screaming that we have too much data.
When I was research director at GigaOM, they wanted to just call me research director for big data. And I knew the term big data would probably fall into disfavor at some point. So I said, can we make it big data and analytics? Because I knew then the big would go away and we'd just call it data and analytics. Of course, GigaOM didn't last till that day, but that's a different story.
Let's talk about the products or the technologies today that you should look at if you want to be able to scale up with data.
Sure. So the foundational big data technology, most of this stuff is open source, by the way.
Sure.
So I won't qualify each one by calling it an open source project. I'll qualify it if it's not, I guess. Is Hadoop, which is an Apache Software Foundation project, and is based on this, originally was based on this algorithm and this concept called MapReduce.
Of course.
MapReduce, a few things to know about it, just to get it in a really compact definition. First of all, it's based on the idea that you're doing things in a distributed, clustered fashion. The more data you have, you scale horizontally, you add more nodes to your cluster so you can take on more work and do it each bit of it at the same time on different machines. The MapReduce algorithm is about taking two passes at the data. The first pass is really just to format it in key value format. And then the second is to go through some aggregation of all of the values for any for each given key. So the first step is the map step.
Sure.
That's the parsing one. And the second step is the reduce step. That was a very monolithic thing in big data for a long time. You will use Hadoop, you will use MapReduce. MapReduce, by the way, was and is a batch-oriented way of working with data.
It is.
If you have a lot of data, the overhead of a batch job, not a big deal, because these are jobs, these are tasks that would take hours or days anyway. But if what we're trying to do is get big data technology to mesh with data discovery software, batch doesn't cut it. So we've needed something that's more interactive. So the Hadoop guys first separated all the software that handled cluster management from the MapReduce algorithm and then set it up so that additional algorithms could be put on the cluster.
I see.
Created a new layer called Tez that could take on more interactive applications. And so it became less monolithic about MapReduce. What then happened was that in some sense, a competing project, also Apache open source, called Spark came on the scene. And now Spark is dominant. The interesting thing about Spark is that it can and often does run on top of Hadoop clusters. So we really have now evolved a standard where people are using Hadoop for storage, cluster management, and are using Spark, which, by the way, is very oriented to memory, which keeps it much more interactive
for sure
than things that are disk-based. And really, they all kind of fit together in one ecosystem. So there's plenty written about Spark versus Hadoop. The de facto reality is that it's Spark plus Hadoop that has evolved.
So let me see if I understand. I always understood the Hadoop HDFS to be this distributed file system. And then there were tons of things on top that you could use to make it look like, for example, there was a way to query these things using some kind of ODBC-like connector.
Yep.
Is Spark, and this is where my confusion is Spark something similar to that, or is it this other thing that's been made to work with Hadoop?
Spark is its own compute framework for working with data that has a SQL layer, much like the one you were alluding to, mm-hmm. which is called Apache Hive.
That's right.
In fact, the two have an identical SQL dialect called HiveQL or mm-hmm. HQL. So it's got a SQL layer. It's got a streaming data component. It's got a machine learning component. It's got a graph component. And then it also has a straight low-level API. And all of this stuff can be programmed, let's say, in Java or Scala or other languages. And you can sort of write one job that does a mix of these things. Mm-hmm. In the Hadoop world, it was more about doing a job that worked at the SQL level, then maybe doing something that did machine learning, then doing something else, each one of those batch job with associated overhead and so forth. Spark mixes it up more. It's very developer friendly. That's a big reason for its momentum. And because it's memory oriented instead of disk oriented, as I mentioned before, users like it. Although they're usually just consuming it downstream with some BI client that uses the SQL interface. But they like it a lot more because it's faster.
So does Spark have its own storage then?
No. Spark has no storage of its own and no cluster management of its own. And that's why it doesn't have to work with Hadoop, but it often does because Hadoop provides both of those. So the Hadoop storage layer that you mentioned, HDFS, the Hadoop Distributed File System, that has become a de facto standard for storing big data. And the Hadoop clusters have become de facto standards for physically hosting big data and the processing around it. And when you add Spark to that, you get a pretty good combination. Spark can also work with Mesos.
Okay.
So it can run, and the company that is the commercial entity most behind Spark, Databricks, their cloud service is Hadoop free. I think that's also a little bit doctrinaire. But in the enterprise, when you see Spark being used, it's typically a combination of Spark and Hadoop.
So I've heard of this thing called the Lambda architecture, mm-hmm. which is, why don't you explain that a little bit so people can get a sense for how you would react to data in both sort of hot and cold paths.
Mm-hmm. So the Lambda architecture is a little bit about having your cake and eating it too, I suppose. The idea is, in a lot of big data scenarios, there's a whole component of data that's streaming in real time, all the time. And you need to be able to handle that and hopefully have a way to do analytics right on that data as it streams in, because you don't want to deal with the latency of having it ingested and shaped and so forth before you can look at it.
Sure.
On the other hand, having the data ingested and shaped so you can look at it makes more complex analyses a lot more feasible. Mm-hmm. So the question is there a way to really synthesize the two so that you can do immediate analysis on data streaming in, and then you can look at more
batch offline type stuff.
Right? Yeah, more sort of past tense data. Although the past tense may only be a few minutes.
Sure.
But the idea is, can you put them both together? So the Lambda architecture is about cobbling together a batch architecture and a streaming architecture and giving users the ability to mix them up.
Is it more of a philosophy, or is there a product guidance that someone can be like, hey, I'm going to use the... I think what I have a hard time with is there a concrete example of things that we can use, or examples of scenarios where this is important so that I know what to use?
Yeah, no, good question. I would say it's more of an aspiration. It is a philosophy. And to some extent, it ends up, as when implemented, being very Rube Goldberg.
Yeah. You know? It's like cobbled together with duct tape and shoestring kind of thing.
Exactly. So I think ultimately where I hope Lambda goes, in effect, is a way, and that we have technology that is ambidextrous mm-hmm. and can sort of deal with both, so that it's not just that we're scotch taping two things together, but we have something that's kind of unified. And it's just that certain data will be, you won't have certain analysis capabilities available on certain data if it's too recent. But I'm a firm believer that the only way to make streaming data analysis useful is that if it is that it will work and feel like working with archival data. You shouldn't have to think about the streaming data differently than you do the stuff that's already stored. I mean, obviously they are different, but I think as technology companies, it's our job to abstract away that mismatch, because it really ought not be the business user's problem. They shouldn't have to think about those distinctions.
And I don't think we're anywhere near that right now, right?
We're in fits and starts, we're getting there. Another open source technology for big data, specifically for streaming, is Apache Kafka. Between their streams and the streaming structures that are now in Spark 2.0, we're getting closer to the idea of looking at streaming data as if it's a table. You just have to get used to the idea that what's in the table actually may change over time.
And that's it. That's interesting. I mean, because that change may be very rapid too.
Yes.
You may look at a table and do a query 1 second, and then the table will be completely different the next second.
Yeah, and I guess if you think about the way different concurrency models work in a relational database, you know, when you go through a long-running transaction, do you maintain the state of the database from when the transaction started, or do you reflect changes midstream? There's different options on databases, and I think it's akin to that. It's obviously a lot more extreme than that.
Sure.
But no database is truly static if it's being used to back a business process. So what we just have to get used to is that the rate of change is accelerating, and that's because we're trying to get everything to be a lot more immediate in terms of what it can tell us about the business.
So let's talk a little bit about Datamere and what you do at your company.
So my role really is to make sure there's coordination between marketing, the product team, and to some extent the sales and the field. And also be the person who's looking at the broader market and not just Datamere. Obviously, some people need to focus on the product and you kind of want them to have tunnel vision. As part of my background and the fact that I write about big data for ZDNet, I'm kind of looking at everybody. So for some extent, that's just about competitive analysis, to be honest. But it's also about seeing trends in the market and trying to funnel that into the product team, so that we can figure out and prioritize what will make the product most useful. The problem with all of the trends in the marketplace is that by the time they're consumable to the business users downstream, you know, a lot has changed.
Yeah.
So it's really Datamere's job to give business users the advantages of those new technologies without having to make them get down into the weeds and kind of learn each one.
So let's just say I'm considering Datamere, what problems will Datamere help me solve as a business?
Virtually any problem that the data can help you solve.
Sure.
Very often that's, you know, look, a lot of data analysis in business comes down to money in some way, shape, or form.
Sure.
Being, making more of it or spending less of it, being more efficient, optimization, a lot of that is what it comes down to. Sometimes it's not about money per se, sometimes it's about operational efficiencies or looking at things like customer satisfaction and so forth. But it's really no different than BI, by the way, right? You still have measures and dimensions. You may not use those words because they seem old-fashioned and like that's your dad's vocabulary for dealing with analytics. But the reality is we still have that stuff. The difference is we try not to be so harsh about modeling all of that up front. We try and do a just-in-time modeling so that when it comes time to do the analysis, that's when we kind of know what's what. We don't worry too much about hierarchies. Everything's a little more permissive. Really, we're still doing the same stuff.
So what does this try to? Can you give me a concrete example of, like, here's a company, you can make up a company, or
sure,
you can use an example and change some names. Here's a company that had this problem, and this is what Datamir came in and did to solve that problem, like the technologies that you put in, et cetera?
Sure. Well, one of our customers that I'm looking at right now actually is focused on the energy space and takes in a ton of data from smart meters and even collected data from old-fashioned, you know, gas and electric meters. And then that data is shared with utilities, and the utilities can do kind of heavy duty analysis on kind of what factors are demographic, geographic, or otherwise are leading to higher energy costs, and how to kind of better optimize distribution on the grid and so forth. Another, also in the energy field, but a different part of it, in oil and gas, has all this data coming from sensors at the oil wells. And so they can look and see which oil wells are more productive, and can then also, they can look at factors that contribute to that productivity, and then they can also allocate resources and priorities based on the wells that are more productive, and they can, you know, they can really have much more profitable quarters, and that's exactly what they've seen.
That's awesome. So is it something that you install on there? I'm trying to get a sense for, like, let's just say I'm the programmer. What is it that I'm doing to make Datamir work? For is it a set of packages? Is it a service? Tell me about that.
Sure. So, I mean, physically, it runs on what we call an edge node, another node in the cluster that that isn't being used by Hadoop or Spark as one of its compute nodes. Although you could co-locate them, but not recommended. And maybe we'll talk about how it fits in with HD Insight, which is Azure's Hadoop and Spark offering. But in terms of the user, the user's just hitting Datamir from the browser and is running browser-based software that introduces a spreadsheet metaphor over all of this.
I see.
And by spreadsheet, I don't just mean that the data is in rows and columns, because that's true of almost every tool. But the way you work with the data in Datamir is that you successively add more columns to a worksheet. You put formulas in the columns using one of over 250 functions, some of which are very pedestrian, doing things like string manipulation, others of which can, like, actually do sentiment analysis on raw text. And as you go from column to column and sheet to sheet, it's sort of like solving a math problem and showing your work step by step.
I see.
And that ends up being a really nice way of working with data. And underneath, what we're doing is we're looking at all the functions. In a sense, it's functional programming, I suppose. And we're compiling that into a job that then runs on Spark or on Hadoop or on some combination of the two. Anyway, that's the gist of it. When you're working with the spreadsheet interactively, we bring a sample of the data and we bring it into memory, so you have an interactive experience. When you're done, you execute the workbook, and that's what dispatches the job out to the Hadoop cluster.
And the results would be sort of the functions would sort of execute and give you the spreadsheet, and then maybe are there visualizations as well?
Yes, we have visualizations as well. We call them business infographics because it's actually a tool built out like that. It's an authoring tool, pixel perfect, not like tiles on a dashboard, which is where most products are these days. But we also have integrations with Tableau. We also have integration with Power BI at this point.
I see.
So you can just kind of use us for data prep and data modeling, and then push out a small data set. Remember, I said the goal is to get to something small. Push out something small either to Tableau or Tableau Online or to Power BI in the cloud or on the desktop, and then go ahead and do your visualization there.
Let's talk about the Azure. You were telling me earlier, you mentioned HD Insight, that there is some integration with Azure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this manifests in a few different ways, but if you come to us and you want our platform as a service cloud product, in fact, in the background, what you'll be doing is spinning up an HD Insight cluster and Datamir on an Azure virtual machine, and you won't even have to worry about that because you just come to us and have a subscription with us and hit Datamir in your browser. Sure. But what's actually happening in the background is it's us plus HD Insight on Linux. Putting HD Insight on Linux, by the way, enabled a ton of scenarios like this with different ISVs in the Hadoop ecosystem, because the Hadoop ecosystem, for all intents and purposes, is Linux only, yeah. right? It's neat that HD Insight runs on Windows, but ultimately what enabled a lot of scenarios was also having it run on Linux. Here's another thing, though. If you go and spin up an HD Insight cluster with your own Azure subscription, there's now in the blade mm-hmm. where you provision the cluster, one of the sections in that blade is called applications. That lets you add different third-party applications to your cluster. Right now, there's only three companies participating in that. We're one of them. We were the very first one. So you can go to the marketplace and bring up Datamere and provision that way, or if you just go to HD Insight, you can add us when you provision your cluster or even later on.
So someone that might be using HD Insight currently and wants this technology is just really easy to add on.
Yes.
That's awesome.
It is. It's just an extra step. Now, of course, there's many different HD Insight cluster types, and we're compatible with a subset of those. So
of
depending on the cluster type you pick, you will or won't see us in the applications section. But if you're picking, it's HD Insight 3.4 running on Linux, you'll see us.
Awesome. So where can people go to find out more about Datamere, and where can people go to read some of the articles that you've been publishing?
Sure. Datamere, pretty easy, www.datamere.com. Mere is M-E-E-R. Datamere is one word. Mm-hmm. And the best way to get to a bunch of the stuff that I've written is to go to bit.ly/bigondata. All one word.
Awesome.
You'll also see articles from my colleagues, Tony Baer and George Anitziotis, because we do it collaboratively now. But that'll give you a feed of just our articles.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put links at the bottom of this particular video. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being with us. We've gotten sort of a good survey of where big data is currently and then some of the work you're doing at Datamere. Thanks for spending some time with us. We are here in a rainy New York. I don't know what this is all about.
It's to make the guys from Seattle feel at home.
I'm here in a rainy New York City, sixth floor of the Midtown Manhattan, New York, Microsoft offices. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.